Oh, welcome to the inaugural episode of the Hero Podcast, where we talk about hope, efficacy, resilience, and optimism, or what I like to call psychological capital. And I have somebody that I've known and I've followed for a long time and have recently started working with. They often refer to him as the rock star of consulting. I like to call him affectionately the drill sergeant of consulting. We have Alan Weiss. Thanks for joining us this morning, Alan.
My pleasure, TJ. Ten Hut.
Well, can I stand at ease?
You may.
Thank you.
As you will.
Thanks. So, Alan, it's a great opportunity for us to have you. Why don't you start off by telling us about some of your newest books that are coming out this year
Well,
and
this
what
year,
else you got going on?
this year's are even for me a remarkable year. I'm 80 years old and I've got five books this year. The first that came out was The Seven Figure Consultant, which talks about the ideas of million-dollar consulting and so forth, but on a very contemporary basis, and how you can get there quickly today, and what seems to be threats are really opportunities. The fifth edition of Getting Started in Consulting, one of my three really best sellers of all time. Only million-dollar consulting has been in more volumes than that, more editions. Then I co-wrote a couple of books with Kirsten Fowler, one of my clients, and these are on project management, and they're also on the fact that you have to focus more on high tech. Sorry, TJ, you have to focus more on high touch when you have high tech. So the higher the tech, the higher the touch, and a lot of project people forget that. Then I have near the end of this year, I think October, The Courage of Your Talent, which talks about there's a decline in self-esteem. People are more confused and vacillating than ever before because of what's going on all over the place. And I talk about the fact that while ego is an external mechanism and it can be fragile, self-esteem is internal and it often suffers because of neglect, not an outside force. So, in a nutshell, those are five books that four of which are out.
Well, that's certainly amazing. It's great to see that even as we continue to, I guess, physically get older, we can still continue to thrive. And I think that's one of the things I always enjoy about when I was following you, and now that I've been working with you, is just to continue to see that journey. It's not over just because we get to a certain age or, we get to a certain point. So I appreciate that. You mentioned your last book, The Courage of Your Talent, and you and I have talking often about self-esteem and so forth. Is it different now than it was? You've talked a lot about your dad and his service in World War II. Is it different now for us than it was for them?
Well, different how? If you mean self-esteem and confidence and so forth, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my father was taught how to jump out of an airplane, right? The first combat infantry parachute regiment ever. He thought it would be a good idea at the time, and then Pearl Harbor hit, and he jumped into
Yeah.
enemy guns in New Guinea. He died at 1 month short of 100, and he was only in the hospital for 2 days. So life's interesting. But the fact is, the late 40s and the 50s and into the 60s were times of great certitude. Families and the economy and business, and you knew who your enemies were and weren't, and so on. Today, though, you have a perfect storm of disruption. And so you have misinformation and disinformation. You have fears about technology. It used to be people were eager to use technology, and now they fear AI, which is just another tool, really. You have supply chains being vulnerable. You have people doubting their own judgments because they don't know to whom to listen. And when COVID hit, especially, COVID will have a much more lasting and insidious impact than AI, because in COVID, people lost respect for journalists, they lost respect for medical authorities, they lost respect for the government, they lost respect for universities, they lost respect for religious institutions, and so on and so on. Some of that is recovering slowly, some of it is not recovering. You can't point to a Walter Cronkite today, or a Huntley and Brinkley. Those folks don't exist. In fact, it's hard to point out to a statesman today, a Tip O'Neill or an Everett Dirksen. They just don't exist. And we're faced with a polarization like we've never seen before. It's not good enough for me to be right. You also have to be wrong, you know? So because of that, the answer to your question is it's much more difficult for people today. Hence, I wrote the book.
Well, that's amazing. When I was in the Sergeant Major's Academy, the first paper I had to write, I got to choose the topic, but it had to be on a historical issue, regarding the military. Everybody is writing about all the famous battles, and I chose to write about Patton and him slapping that soldier in, reportedly slapping that soldier in the hospital in during World War II. And I did it because I wanted to point out how the things that you just talked about, our self-esteem, our self-confidence and stuff, was changing. And I pointed out that for Patton, one of the only generals of World War II that served and saw action in World War I, that he didn't understand what was going on. It was foreign to him to see somebody so to the point that they couldn't move or couldn't, act. And then now we see where we're at from there. It's almost like it's become so pervasive. I was
Well,
reading in the Wall Street. Go ahead.
I've studied the military. It's a favorite topic of mine. So let me give you an example about judgment. The Russians have lost a lot of generals in Ukraine. They've lost 325,000 soldiers dead, according to the New York Times. But they lose the generals because they're in the front lines, because the Russians don't trust the judgment of the commissioned and non-commissioned officers on the front lines. So they send the generals. Generals get killed. In the Civil War, which I think changed history, not just the United States. I think it changed history. The battle that changed the Civil War was Gettysburg, because if Lee wins Gettysburg, he marches to Washington, he takes Washington, the British join with their fleet, and it's over. Gettysburg was won by one key battle, one minor battle, when the 20th Maine was on Little Round Top, and Confederate soldiers were coming up with cannon, which would have provided a, what is it called, an enfilade, a flanking.
Blanking.
For the whole Union line, would have driven the Union line right out of Gettysburg. So Joshua Chamberlain, who's the colonel in charge of the 20th Maine up there, repels three attacks, but they run out of ammunition. And there's just enough light left for one more attack, and the Confederates come on one more time. And Chamberlain issues one of the most famous orders in the history of the military. He says, "Fix bayonets, charge." And so the bedraggled remainders of the 20th Maine run down the hill. The Confederates, brave men, just thought one thing: that has to be reinforcements. These have to be new, fresh troops. And they ran, and Little Round Top was saved, and so was Gettysburg. Chamberlain and the 20th Maine, if you're ever in Gettysburg, have a monument there. They gave him the Medal of Honor, and he later became governor of Maine. Now, a lot of people dispute some aspects of that story, but the point is, Chamberlain did issue the order, and Chamberlain used his judgment on the site, you know? And the colonels then were elected. They weren't appointed by some god or senior. They were elected, and they raised a regiment. So, judgment in the military, judgment in politics, judgment in education. You hear today somebody's accused of racial slurs or anti-Semitic slurs or misogynist comments, bad treatment toward women and minorities. And they say later, once they're caught, "That wasn't really me. That's not who I am." Yes, it is. That's exactly who you are. So, judgment's everything, and if you have good judgment, you have preventive action, and you don't have to hire lawyers to defend you later.
You mentioned in one of you talked. I want to talk about since you're a fan of military history and General Eisenhower. You mentioned in your book Thrive, and it stuck with me how basically talked about his resilience and how he went. He had never commanded before, let alone commanded in battle. What made him able to go from being, in your opinion, from being, a staff officer to leading the, I mean, what's probably still today the largest, invasion, multi-front war ever.
We talked about ego and we talked about self-esteem before. And if you have a high self-esteem and your ego is intact, you can have great confidence. And confidence, I'll define that. Confidence is the belief that you can help someone even though you've never done before what they expect you to do. So you don't have to have driven at 220 miles an hour. You feel you can. You don't have to perform this kind of surgery. You know you can because you've performed different surgery. And Eisenhower felt, I think, the same way. And it was that confidence. And because of that confidence, one thing that I know you know about as well is he was one of the few people, they called Lincoln's cabinet a team of rivals. Eisenhower was one of the few people who could put up with the British, with the French. I mean, de Gaulle and who's the Brit that British officer with the huge ego?
Oh, I know who you're talking about, and I can see his name right. I can see his face, but I can't.
So these people have huge egos. They want an Eisenhower, but he could somehow accommodate them. And then, but his real test came when he only had one day left of proper tides, and the weather was iffy. And he was going to launch a million men across the channel. He thought in the face of German panzers, which of course never showed up. And he said, "Now or never," and off they went.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. So, I think if you have that kind of confidence, he was a pretty good president. And he had never served in that kind of office before either. And he was elected to a second term, and he had a very serious heart attack. I think he might have had two, if I remember correctly. But he served out the term. So, somebody said once, there are no great moments in history. There are only ordinary people who rise up to face those challenges and become great people.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and it makes me think of this time I was in basic training. I was at the end of my training, and there it's called I think Victory Forge. It's meant to it's I think it's called oh Nick we affectionately call it Nick at Night. And so they tell you that if you don't low crawl once the bunker alarm goes off, if you just even raise your head up a little bit, that your head's just gonna explode in a pink mist. In reality, these 50 caps, you could stand on three people on three Shaquille O'Neals on top of each other, and they're locked in a gun vise. They're not going to deviate. They're just shooting over the top of your head really high. Bunker goes off. The alarm goes off, and I'm just frozen. Drill Sergeant, I'll never forget his name. Drill Sergeant Kelsey Goodson picks me up by my load-bearing vest and throws me over the burn, and I just started crawling like it was. Like it was natural. I tell people from that point on, like you said, there's lots of things, especially as I got, to the more senior levels that I never experienced. You get a call from somebody and you're like, how do I solve this? I've never done this. I've never, and it taught me resilience. So I'm very thankful for it. What do you see that that's, is that lacking today, that confidence that Eisenhower's, I mean, comparing apples to apples or oranges to oranges amongst our top leaders or against the most successful, is that what's there? Is that what makes them successful?
Yeah, by the way, it's Field Marshal Montgomery. We were trying to
Yes,
think.
thank you. Erwin Montgomery.
I didn't use AI, it just came back. To answer your question, I think that what you're seeing is pseudo confidence. You're seeing people who are blowhards. You're seeing a lot of statements made that don't turn out to be true. You see them retracted. Among politicians, especially, of both parties, you see a lot of hot air. And political wind, and bloviation. And so I think it's very difficult today to see people of great confidence standing out, especially if you take out the Musks and the Bezos and the people who are wealthier than God, right? Who, a trip or a fault or even a major loss is nothing to them. But if you look at people in responsible positions, look what happens to the heads of these Ivy League universities. I mean, most of them are dismissed or gone, usually in some kind of disgrace. And I don't find people, and I mentioned Walter Cronkite before, or Edward R. Murrow, you can think about, these kinds of almost legendary people don't exist today. There's nobody who has that kind of confidence imbued by, the general public. So I think that when I said that COVID has changed society permanently, it's because we've lost this trust in people and institutions where we vested our trust. It's like having money in the bank and the bank goes bust and your money's gone.
We don't have those people that we can rely on. We don't know with, another thing I'm noticing, and I think it'll continue to progressively get worse maybe, is understanding with AI and how our potential enemies might use it, whether that's corporate or, that's military, is are we going to be able to know what's real or not? Are we, in terms of like somebody posts a video of Alan Weiss choking his dog on the internet, because they're trying to take away your business, how do we know whether it's real or not?
I'll tell you, I'll give you two predictions for the short-term future so you can hold me to them. One is that
Thanks.
there's going to be some government authority, organization, institute that verifies what's real and what's not. And if you don't have this, it used to be called the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval back in the day. If you don't have this imprimatur, then you can't trust the source, whether it's audio, video, whatever it is, you can't trust it. But if you have that, they've tested it for everything. And just like, I said to my two granddaughters are looking at colleges now. They're twins, and they'll go after their senior year, and they're preparing their applications and papers, and you have to write an essay. I said, does the college have these colleges? Do they have software that tests to see if these were AI generated? And they said, oh yeah, if you use AI, there's a way they detect it somehow. So there's going to be some test of real versus not real. The other prediction I'll make to you is this, though. Because it is so overwhelming and non-preventable in many cases, the people are going to be really hit harder in the arts. People who write, for example, they write songs, they write teleplays, they write, they're playwrights, they're going to get hard. Actors are going to get hit hard. Musicians are going to get hit hard. And there's going to have to be a separate award. I think that the awards, the Tonys and the Emmys and the Oscars and so forth, the Grammys, they're going to have to separate real and unreal. I mean, look what Disney is doing now with animated stuff. And so they have a feature now for animated movies, right? And Frozen or whatever, they compete in these. There's an article in the New York Times just a week or two ago from nowhere less than China, where Chinese actors who were in big demand in these swashbuckling movies, of ancient Chinese warriors, now can't get a job because they're using AI to depict these mighty jumps and leaps and sword fights. You don't need a sword fight anymore where you fake killing someone. You can really kill somebody in animation, right? In special effects. So we're already seeing this. So the whole entertainment industry, I mean, if you can celebrate a Michael Jackson movie, which they're doing now, who had a horribly tarnished career, clearly a pedophile, then why can't you celebrate something that's completely artificial as though it were real? So this is going to be a tremendously ambiguous field in the future.
Yes, I shared with you, I was talking to someone about a speaking engagement the other day, and they're in the cybersecurity sector in the DoD field. And I told him, well, the biggest challenge you're going to have is not all these technical configurations you're going to do. What we're facing is being able to determine whether that message from the general or that message from the CEO is real. And I said, the social proof is in 2024, a whole, a board thought they were watching a presentation from a CEO, and turns out it was all AI generated by somebody that was trying to do, do the organization harm. So it'll be interesting, definitely. What, in spite of all of that, how do we operationalize, build that internal psychological capital that's going to propel us forward to continue to be successful, in your opinion?
Well, you have to keep learning. I tell people you have to empty your mind, which sounds counterintuitive. But we go to Nantucket every year, and in the house that we rent, there's a studio which becomes my office, and I do my writing at 6 in the morning. As we're staring at the Atlantic. And one of those years, I'm looking out, and there's as there always is, a slew of robins come down early in the morning, and they're pulling worms out of the ground. And I said, well, the mantra, the early bird gets the worm. And then I'm thinking, yeah, but the early worm gets eaten. And so you have to start turning things on its head. You have to start thinking very differently. People talk today, to give you a contemporary example, about toxic workplaces. I go on LinkedIn every morning for two reasons. One, to realize how really fortunate I am not to be involved in that crap. And secondly, anybody who mentions me favorably, I thank, because I think it's important to do that. And a lot of people cite me. But I'm constantly eliminating people because, there are so many morons on LinkedIn talking about things. They're talking about leadership and team building, these things, which they've never done, right? But they have charts and graphs, all right? I've worked with CEOs at Fortune 500 companies, and they don't consult a chart or a graph to make a decision. But anyway, what you have to do is, in a contemporary basis, here's the example. Everybody's talking on about toxic workplaces. Toxic, this 52% of workplaces are toxic. Most CEOs know it's toxic. And of course, that's not true. I'm talking about toxic employees. I'm talking about people who are entitled and don't feel they need to change, but feel they need more. They should have more money and better positions, even though they're not worth it. So if you have enough toxic employees, you don't fire them, you get a toxic workplace. So strike at the cause, right? Soak the rich, right? Soak the rich. Yeah, that's a really good idea. So you keep soaking the rich, and the rich leave, and the rich move, and they put that money where it can't be found. And so pretty soon, there's nobody left to tax. So you do not end poverty by creating more of it. Now, when you present people with these ideas, you lose some of them. They get pissed off. They think they know more than you do, and that's fine. I'm not trying to convert anyone. I'm trying to help people who believe in what I'm talking about to be better at what they do. And if you look at the great audience generators in the past, Steve Harvey and Don Imus and Howard Stern and Walter Winchell, they knew exactly who their audience was, and they fed that audience to help them. They weren't interested about converting. So th that this is the tenor of the times, and social media can be helpful. I'll give you one more quick example. I was doing so, I don't know, I was creating something. Maybe it was a workshop or something. And I said to AI, what would Alan Weiss say about this workshop? And of course, it regurgitated all of my stuff, right? However, 15% of it I had forgotten. My stuff, nobody else's. But I've been doing this for so long, I've had so many good ideas, I can't remember them all at once. And in putting this thing together, which I usually do in 20 minutes on a legal pad, it reminded me of stuff that I could use again. That's really using AI as a tool and not being scared of it and not using it to plagiarize.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, that's one of the things that one of the biggest takeaways I've gotten from working with you was emptying your mind. Normally, so if I was meeting with General Weiss, and this is, I would have highly scripted everything I was going to say. I would have told you, I would have had it. I would have practiced it. I would have had it memorized. Bear, and I don't do that anymore. I try. I've been increasingly trying to go, like you said, keep your mind empty so that you can really see where those things goes. And I've noticed that, that helps reduce the anxiety. That helps reduce the all this meta stuff about, the meta stuff about stuff.
Well, people tell you to stay in the moment. You can't stay in the moment if your mind is spinning on what you're going to say in the next moment. So the key thing is, if you empty your mind, you can stay in the moment.
Well, thanks for sharing that. The other thing I've appreciated about you is you just, you just, you lay it out and you say, hey, this is what you got to start doing. And by doing that, what I've also realized, that helps build that self-esteem, that help builds that, self-confidence. And that's why I kind of affectionately call you the drill sergeant of consulting, because that's exactly how the Army takes, enlisted and officers, and takes them from being civilians to being, to being soldiers. I really appreciate that. What's the last thing you want to leave us with today?
I'll just say something quickly, and then I'll tell you the last thing. And that is the concept of training people began with the Army in World War II, when people had to be trained. The people had never gone more than 25 miles from their homes. The United States was an isolationist country, and suddenly we had to train hundreds of thousands of people to make machines, to fight, to jump out of airplanes, and so forth. And so that was really the training industry that began back there. What I'd like to leave everybody with, and thank you for having me on today, I appreciate it, in your inaugural broadcast. I'd like to leave everybody with the understanding that you have to have the both efficacy and the esteem to succeed. So efficacy is how well you do things, but esteem is the fact that you're worthy. And even though you might do something not well, it doesn't make you less of a worthy person. And so, by your humanity, by your identity, you are worthy. Don't let anyone ever take that away.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. I appreciate you for joining us today. It's always great to be able to talk with you, and I hope you have a great day. Thanks for joining
Thank
us,
you.
Alan.
Thanks for the opportunity. See you
You're
soon.
welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.